Okay, so welcome to PopCan podcast episode number one.
On January 17th, 2013.
I'm Susan Underhill, and I'm one of the co-hosts.
And I'm Miran Zaveri, and I'm the other co-host.
So this podcast is a pop culture podcast, and with a Canadian perspective, and we have our Canadian accents, Miran with her...
half Canadian, half British accent.
Which is very Canadian in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And so I think that most of the stuff we're going to cover in our podcast is going to be U.S., Hollywood, North American stuff, but we'll there's a bit more BBC and CBC influence in our stuff, and definitely our perspective, our political perspective, differs dramatically from Americans. So that's sort of what the podcast is about.
Okay, so I'll go through our list of topics for this podcast. So we're going to start with movie reviews. We're going to talk about the Les Mis movie and Zero Dark Thirty. So we're going to do a recap of the Golden Globe Awards, and then we're going to do our TV reviews. We'll go through some PopCan recommendations, and then we'll tell you where to find us online.
Okay, and I think we're also going to do a pop essay.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
we're going to discuss an essay. All right, so first up is our movie reviews, and we're going to cover Les Mis and Zero Dark Thirty. So why don't you start with your review of Les Mis?
Well, I actually quite enjoyed the movie. You know, there were a lot of reviews talking about how incredibly long it was. There were lots of reviews criticizing Russell Crowe, which I thought was a little bit unfair, because I thought he did actually quite a good job. It certainly is, like, it's a visual feast. It's a really beautiful movie to watch. You know, I wasn't put off by the singing, as many reviewers were. You know, I wasn't...
Because everything is sung.
Everything, every word.
Yeah.
There isn't, you know...
Recitative or something it's called.
Yeah, something like that. which tells you how much I know about sort of musical form. But, you know, again, I thought it was really well done. You know, a lot of people told me to take a hanky with me because I was almost certainly going to cry. And I did not find it sort of like an emotional movie. For me, it really was just a, you know, it was a musical from the stage, you know, made into a movie. And that's sort of how I took it right from the beginning. So, I mean, I found the stage production considerably more emotional.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because you're quite, I mean, so the reviews I read about it and whatnot were similar. Certainly Slate was, they were complimentary, but they talked about the plotting recitative. Mm. And I guess they found, like, every word being sung was a little bit too much. You know, but I thought, and as well that the singing wasn't refined, that it was very rough, that yeah. Anne Hathaway's, you know, it isn't the most beautiful rendition of what's the song that her
A Dream
song?
A Dream.
A Dream, A Dream, of course.
But, you know, I mean, it really was quite lovely. And I think it was exactly what I expected it to be. I expected it to be really pretty to look at, and it was. And I expected for it to be really entertaining in terms of the singing, and it was.
Yeah. I think that I think because it is a movie adaptation, I think the choice of you know, having them emote and not be perfect singers, I think was the right choice, because the difference between the stage and a movie is the distance you are, right? So to do the ultra close-ups of Anne Hathaway singing her song, and, you know, that's what you can do with film that you can't do on stage. So I think that was, you know, that makes sense to me. And, yeah. So, So you didn't mind the recitative, and you enjoyed every performance?
I don't think I was expecting as much as many, you know, really sort of hardcore Les Mis fans. I was expecting a really entertaining movie, and that's exactly what I got.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk about Zero Dark Thirty. I really enjoyed this movie as well. I think it was... I think she presents a really sort of unambiguous picture that torture and violence is a necessary part of war, or these times, whichever. But what I found really interesting was that the main character that Jessica Chastain plays is Maya. And she never actually has to, she doesn't enjoy violence herself. She, during the scenes where they're interrogating the prisoners, she cringes when there's violence. And there's a scene where she's interrogating Faraj, Abu Faraj, and she has like a heavy beside her and she hits him on the shoulder when she wants him to slap him around. So she doesn't actually have to do any of the violence herself. And then the right up to the point where they're actually going into Bin Laden, and she asks the Chris Pratt character, she says, "I need you guys to go in and kill Bin Laden for me."
Wow.
Yeah. So, so I thought that Jessica Chastain was very, very good. James Gandolfini surprised me. You know,
right, because he played Leon Panetta. Right?
Yes. So he just sort of pops up and took me a minute to sort of recognize him. But I didn't like Chris Pratt being in it. When he popped up on the screen, I was like, what's he doing here? Because he was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And it just didn't fit at all. And the other SEAL Team 6 characters weren't like that at all.
So, I mean, one of the things that thus far has kept me away from this movie is the whole sort of depiction of torture and its value. I mean, what was your sense?
I said it was unambiguous. I think she's making the point that it's a necessary evil. But certainly what I guess is more ambiguous is that it isn't easy. It isn't something that, doesn't affect you. The reviews I've read as well make a big deal about the final scene where she's where she looks at Bin Laden, and I'm sure that it would have it would have screened better had they, you know, she like pumped her fist or had a little wry smirk on her face or something, but she just, you know, tears come in her eyes, and it wasn't as emotional as I was expecting it to be after having read the reviews or heard the reviews, but certainly, you know, I think that she conveyed a lot there, and I'm not sure that it was about the violence necessarily. I think it was more about, like, that was, you know, 10 years of her life, now what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a void in her life, and you know, and I think that what has she solved by killing this man?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and the torture didn't, there's one piece of information they get from the torture that sort of leads them down. It takes them,
mm-hmm.
you know, 5 or more years to get to that other.
Which sort of begs the question, is that the only way they could have gotten that information?
Well, later, as the political environment changes and they sort of get called on
Guantanamo, Gitmo.
Yeah, Gitmo and those things. So the political environment changes and they can't use that tactic as the film progresses. And so they start bribing instead. So there's...
Well, and they started using things like rendition as well, which is, you know, also pretty appalling.
Yeah. So
perhaps not in this particular context, but...
Yeah. Anyway, so I didn't find the torture scenes disturbing. That wasn't... I've seen worse on television,
mm-hmm.
to be honest. But no, so I thought it was a really well executed movie,
yeah.
And I thought Kathryn Bigelow just did an awesome job with the material.
Yeah.
I did hear one podcast, and they were asking whether or not the movie had to be made, and I thought that was an interesting American perspective on it, because it's this sort of revenge fantasy idea. Like, was it necessary for Americans to sort of see that depiction? So I thought that was
Which is an interesting question, isn't it? Because, I mean, I think that they do need to see it. I just, my challenge with the movie is that, you know, it is, you know, even though the director over and over again has said, this is a movie, it was inspired by real life events. It is a movie. It is meant to be provocative.
Yeah.
It is not meant to be sort of like, you know, a diary of what actually happened. But it will be treated as such.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I think it's important for, you know, the population of a country like the US, and frankly, even a country like our own. I think that there's something, you know, very wrong with stripping somebody of their dignity. I think there's something wrong with torture, as I'm sure many people do. But, you know, strangely, like, I love her movies. I loved The Hurt Locker.
Yeah. Well, I'm fascinated with the psychology of soldiers. I mean, I studied psychology, and I remember we had a guest lecturer once who talked about... the psychology of killing, and how and so it's always fascinated me. So you change the one thing soldiers do, for example, is they change the language. So they don't talk about murdering someone; they talk about smoking someone, or, you know, and they have all kinds of nicknames for the enemy. Right? It's never, they dehumanize it.
Yeah.
So they distance themselves. And so that whole psychology just fascinates me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I honestly don't know how you can, how a soldier can be trained to kill or torture or whatever, and then expect to go back and be a loving family man with a relationship.
But you know what? Like, I mean, it makes sense to me that soldiers, you know, sort of employ this coping mechanism. It makes less sense to me that the general populace would start using the same vocabulary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's why we find those movies much more disturbing, because we're not trained. You know, we're not trained soldiers.
Well, no, I mean, for me, the point is, like, you know, I don't want to be a trained soldier.
No, I know.
You know, I want to... I don't know. I mean... I'm very conflicted about the whole thing. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, yeah. But I think you're right. I think that she, you know, she does make it intentionally provocative. So,
the next thing on our list of items is a recap of the Golden Globe Awards.
All right. So, what did we think of Tina Fey and Amy Poehler to start with?
I found them really entertaining. I so enjoyed them.
Yeah, I thought they did really, really well as well. You know, I thought that, you know, they started it just by doing a shout out to all the different ladies, and then they had all the different jokes. And I loved the joke they did about Kathryn Bigelow. Saying, you know, that we don't, you know, don't really follow the torture thing, but admire anyone who has spent 3 years or 6 years married to James Cameron. That was good. I thought it landed well.
That was great.
I also liked the joke about Anne Hathaway being abandoned by James Franco. That was great.
Yeah. I like the bits when they started, like, you know, I mean, obviously they weren't really drinking, one hopes, but like I loved it when they had the drinks in their hands. That's when it started to get really fun for me. It did sometimes feel like they felt like they needed to one up Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, and when they did, I thought that they felt they seemed a little uncomfortable. Like yeah. They tried to reel it back a little bit. Yeah, so that was good. So best moments?
You know what, I have to say, like, I was very touched by the Jodie Foster moment when she accepted her award. And I know that, you know, it rambled a little bit. It was a little bit all over the place. It was like, you know, so clear what she was about to do and then the pulling back. But it felt very genuine. Like, you know, I mean, in that moment, I really felt for her. Yeah. And, you know, I just think there is somebody who, you know, on principle for many, many years has just really guarded her privacy. And, you know, then she's made this decision, you know, for whatever reason, you know, to make sort of her personal life quite public.
She's guarded other people's privacy as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's stand by Mel Gibson. I thought it was weird he was there with her. I think she's taken that friendship a little far. And I also thought, you know, but she stood up for Kristen Stewart this year and wrote.
Well, I mean, thank goodness somebody did. You know, I think sometimes we forget, like, she's really quite young.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, and I found it a bit rambly. I thought that when she got to her mom, it was good.
Mm.
Yeah, but for me, I think the best moment was when Salma Hayek and Paul Rudd lost their mic, and they just stood there, or they lost their teleprompter. They had their mic, which was too bad for them, because I was expecting something from Paul Rudd.
I think, like, he delivered. I have to say, like, I thought that was really funny.
He stood there and he went, "Hi there.
How is everyone?" It was
lame. That was terrible. Terrible. Yeah. I thought that they could have done more. So, a couple of surprises. I thought, obviously, Argo was a big surprise.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I think, and that made it Ben Affleck's night, mm-hmm. really, because, you know, there's so much talk about him being snubbed by the Academy and not being, I guess it was nominated for Best Film, but not for Best Director. But there's 9 films now for Best Film. So not everyone who's in Best Film is going to get a Best Director.
Mm-hmm. I'll be very curious to see if Steven Spielberg actually wins for Best Director when it comes to the Oscars. Because, I mean, you know, that was a terrific set of films that were nominated, you know, both for the Golden Globes. And, you know, I mean, I would imagine for the Oscars as well.
Yeah. So, so that was a big surprise. And then I didn't really think that Lena Dunham would win for Girls. I was glad she did.
Yeah.
But I really thought those were the two. It was their night. Mm-hmm. You know, they won it. I was... and Lena Dunham was so cute. She couldn't walk in heels.
I don't know if that's cute.
Aw, I thought it was cute. She does need to learn to walk in heels, but it was very cute.
Okay, I will give my 2 surprises. One, it's less surprise, more disappointment. So I was quite disappointed that Tommy Lee Jones didn't win for Best Supporting Actor, because, I mean, I thought he did, you know, a really wonderful job in Lincoln. You know, he's sort of like good at the wry, sort of, you know, deadpan kind of roles. And
like he did at the Golden Globes.
Golden Globes. But I thought he delivered, you know, a really sort of nuanced performance. And there were moments where, you know, he was willing to let himself look really weak, you know, but more from sort of like a human frailty perspective as opposed to, you know, like weakness of mind.
I think he was just well cast for that role, because he was, yeah, I think he is kind of cold and hard to read and stoic. And so, you know, and that role demanded that.
But see, I mean, I found that the role, like in that particular role, he was not hard to read. Right? Like, I mean, it was very much on his sleeve.
Yeah, but it was intentional that he would be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
When he tried to emote, right? Like, that was sort of the point. So,
anyway,
so
I mean, that said, I haven't seen Django Unchained. So,
right.
The other, I mean, I guess it's really only a surprise to me, and it wasn't really a surprise. I just, you know, I mean, having seen Les Mis, I don't really understand why Anne Hathaway won.
Oh, really?
You know, she's actually not in the movie for very long.
Yes, that's true.
So I was a bit surprised by that.
And the only Canadian won, Michael Dana. He won for best score for Life of Pi. Oh, he mentioned Toronto twice. It's very exciting. Yep.
All right. So we're now going to move on to TV reviews. And so we're reviewing a couple of things. So we're reviewing the premiere of the second season of Girls and the premiere of the third season of Downton Abbey.
Yeah, so Girls, Girls, the tone changed a little bit, I think, this season. So it opened up with Hannah spooning Elijah. And so they are roommates now, and he apologizes for his boner and says, "It's not you." So she's a lot more confident in this. So she's got a new boyfriend. There's a lot. She's naked a lot in it.
Oh.
And I'm not sure, you know.
What is with that?
I'm not. I mean, people just love, because she's not your typical beauty and everything, that she's doing that and she's putting herself out there. But honestly, she does it so much, and it's just, and none of the other characters do.
I don't feel like I really need to see anybody naked that much.
No. So she's naked a couple of times. She's naked when she's her new boyfriend is Danny Glover, from Community.
Right.
So she's naked when she's fucking him, and then she's naked when she's changing for her party. So her and Elijah are planning a housewarming party, and they love each other as roommates. And there's a scene where they're decorating the apartment for their housewarming party, and talking about all the different themes they're going to have for all the different parties, and Elijah starts talking about French salons, and it's completely, like, she's talking about her hair. She thinks French salon's a hair thing, and then, like, it all goes completely over her head, and then they end it with, "You're the best roommate ever," in unison. So you're kind of left with thinking they're not gonna,
it's not gonna go well,
it's not gonna stay beautiful forever. Shoshana is ends the, oh, and I didn't talk about Adam, sorry. So she also is taking care of Adam. So her boyfriend from last season gets hit by a truck at the end of last season, and so he can't even wipe his own ass.
Oh.
So she's got to look after him and care for him, and he is and she doesn't want to be with him anymore. She wants to be with Danny Glover now, and so she's keeps trying to talk to him, and he's being really, really mean to her the whole time. And Adam is. And
what a surprise.
Yeah. And she says, "But, you know, you don't even seem to really like me. Why are you, you know, why do you, or you're being really mean to me. Why do you even want me around?" And he answers, "Well, you don't always have to be nice to someone you love." So she's in trouble because she doesn't want that. So Shoshana, I find her the least interesting character, and so she's trying to get over the fact that she lost her virginity last year, and and Ray still seems interested in her. So we'll see what happens with that. Marnie. Things are going very, very poorly for her. She loses her job very awkwardly. She has to listen to Charlie go on and on about his new girlfriend and how much he loves her. And then she ends up, Elijah says that he's bi, and they start to have sex. And then he can't get it up, and he blames it on the fact that she rolled her eyes. So he leaves and he storms off, and she ends up at Charlie's door just saying she needs to sleep beside somebody. So she's kind of up. And then I didn't even recognize the other girl.
Blondie.
Yes, Blondie. And but she's married now to Chris O'Dowd.
Oh, I love him.
Yes.
I did not love him in the last season of Girls, but I guess she's found it some redeeming feature. I love Chris O'Dowd, the actor.
Yes, yes. Anyway, so yeah, so they're back from their honeymoon, and she's like, I don't even know where you live. So who knows how
that's
going to
be. Seems very much like Blondie.
So it's, yeah, it's going to be, yeah, so the tone, Hannah's a bit more confident. Marnie's kind of losing everything. Shoshana, you know, might actually be, get out of her sort of childlike.
She seems troubled a lot of the time.
Yes.
It's a lot of angst.
Yes. Anyway, so that's sort of the recap of Girls.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it.
All right.
Thanks for telling me what I can expect.
All right, Downton.
Okay, so season 3 started, and did we get the wedding? Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I expected, like, a really big sort of hoo-ha about the wedding, you know, of, you know, I don't remember
Mary.
People's names. Yeah, Mary and the dude she married.
Yeah.
That guy.
The old guy.
It was very nice, but, you know, they didn't actually spend a lot of time with it. But, you know, it's all done. They're married. You know, there are some significant issues with money. Really significant issues with money that, you know, may result in the loss of Downton. And then miraculously, money appears, but there is angst around that money. Should I spend it? Should I not spend it? It seems that I may have gotten it in the wrong way.
So the guy, the heir.
Yes, that guy.
He's back.
He's back.
And he has all the money now.
He now has all the money. He got it from, do you remember Lavinia? Poor Lavinia. For season 2. I'm sorry. I love watching this show, but I do have some trouble taking it seriously. Right? Because, I mean, I hope everybody understands that it is a work of complete fiction. You know, the costumes might be about right. That's about it. So I just, I enjoy it. I enjoy it in the same way as I enjoy General Hospital. So, yeah. So Dan Stevens is, you know, the guy who plays the heir. Matthew. His name is Matthew. So Matthew and Mary get married and, you know, they're having a lovely time.
No. The other heir.
What other heir?
The guy I thought there was another... I'm thinking of another movie.
I think you might be.
All right.
Yeah. So anyway, it's very entertaining. I like Sybil, who is the one who ran away and married the chauffeur. She's great. She's one of the sisters. And then I've forgotten the name of the other sister who thinks she's rather plain. But she's
probably one of
my favorite characters. My least favorite character.
I'm not confused because they had the vet came back. He was Canadian.
Oh, that guy.
And his
the
face.
Guy was, yeah.
And his face was and he said that he was the cousin.
No, he disappeared.
Because they didn't believe him.
Yeah.
So he's not an issue anymore.
No.
That was just a short plot point.
It was a very short plot
okay.
point.
So
yeah.
Why didn't they think that they had any money then?
So, you know how, you know, the Earl, I've forgotten that guy's name as well. He, like, you know, in
I
these...
I think we're going to have to do a little bit more research.
I might have to write some names down. But anyway, you know, in this world, I mean, and this is actually true as well, men are in charge of all the money. And
yeah.
Sometimes they make poor choices. Like, and I, you know, I don't know how you're going to feel about this, but he invested heavily in the Canadian railways when then they got nationalized. So they lost all the money.
Well, why? Why do you thought that I'd be offended by more Canadian than you are? All right.
So then, you know, they're thinking they're going to have to sell Downton. And then Matthew gets a letter, and it's from Lavinia's father's lawyer. And, you know, of course, poor Lavinia died. But, you know, she had apparently written to her father extolling all of Matthew's virtues and saying, like, you know, this terrible thing has happened. He's been so good to me. Even though he's really in love with somebody else, he's prepared to stick by me. I think that's the sign of, like, a really great guy.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
So, you know, I mean, as a result, you know, poor Lavinia dies and, you know, her father doesn't have any other heirs. So he selects three people and Matthew is one of them. And miraculously, they cannot find the other two heirs that are ahead of Matthew.
Oh, so that's why Matthew thinks that he doesn't deserve the money.
Yeah, he thinks he doesn't deserve the money, but he didn't know about the letter that Lavinia wrote. Yeah, it is rather
General Hospital. Yeah.
But it's a lot of fun. I'm not going to start watching.
No, neither am I. I have the first two episodes downloaded, ready to watch. Yeah. So, all right. So, the next item is our pop essay discussion. So we're going to talk about Ring of Fire, which was in Vogue, this February issue of Vogue. And it's by Silvana Paternostro. And it's about her, she's Latin, and she doesn't want to date Latin men, and she ends up
falling in love with a Latin man. I read this article, I actually just read it yesterday. And, you know, it resonated for me in a lot of ways. So, you know, here is this incredibly accomplished woman. And she sets the essay up by sort of talking about all of the, you know, the really impressive things that she's done, right? So, she's from a reasonably well-to-do family, I think, in Latin America and Colombia. But, you know, she decided, I think, long ago that she was really going to do sort of her own thing. She has this real sense of adventure. She becomes a journalist. And, you know, she sort of resolves within herself not to marry a Latin man. And, you know, she sort of is talking to some of her friends, and her friend is trying to set her up with somebody and, you know, explains that this, you know, incredibly accomplished man is, you know, is Latin American. Isn't that wonderful? And she's sort of like, well, no, you know, I don't like Latin men generally. They don't like me. And, you know, I mean, and that's where it started to really resonate for me.
So why did it resonate with you?
She is, I think she grew up in a culture that in many respects is a lot like the culture I grew up in, where, you know, women are sort of seen.
Which is Indian.
Indian, and not so much heard. Women work. In the home, outside of the home, they're expected to do sort of, you know, backbreaking work, but they're not expected to express any opinion. They're expected to not have any desire to have any control over any aspect of their life. And, you know, I mean, she describes a lot of that. She describes, you know, sort of having a boyfriend and her boyfriend deciding one day that he just wasn't going to speak to her because she was reading a book that he didn't approve of. You know, and
Sybil.
Yeah.
She was reading Sybil.
She was reading Sybil. And, you know, I could completely sympathize with her not wanting to be a part of that world. I mean, I think it's interesting because there's been lots of studies done about sort of interracial dating.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the studies sort of, you know, fairly conclusively show that women tend to want to date within their own culture. It's men generally who are more open to dating outside of their culture.
Really?
And yet that's not
surprising
true for me at all. I feel very guilty about, you know, having no desire to date any Indian men. But that's still the way I feel. And, you know, I think it's lovely that, you know, this woman managed to find somebody.
Well, I mean, the other thing that she does is she works almost exclusively in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this very strong draw, while at the same time she's repelling right? So there's, but she's a journalist, so she's covering sort of all the negative aspects of Latin America and the drug wars and the Cold War and all of these things, Noriega, and but that she's exclusively covering Latin America in her journalism. So I think that when she meets this man, she still is, you know, grappling with those two halves of herself, the need, the desire she has to reinforce her culture, and at the same time not to reinforce the sexism and the things she doesn't like about the culture.
I don't know. I mean, you know what? I don't know that I agree with that. Like, there's a lot that I really love about Indian culture.
Think there's a lot she loves about Latin culture.
You know, what I don't love about Indian culture is the way that women are viewed. And, you know, it is really, you know, my entire childhood, you know, all the way to being sort of a young woman. That's what's really informed my view of Indian men. And I have to say, like, you know, and I think it's different for young women growing up in an Indian culture now, particularly, you know, if they're a part of sort of like the diaspora. And I think actually, even if they're actually in India, but certainly of my generation, you know, sort of born to immigrants, you know, I have seen nothing that would persuade me otherwise than I currently feel, which is just,
stay away from Indian men. Yeah, well, so why don't we just leave it there?
Okay.
Miran will stay away from Indian men.
But continue to feel guilty about it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. So, recommendations. What's your recommendation?
Well, I do recommend that article. It is called Ring of Fire. It's in the February edition of Vogue, US, and it is written by Silvana Paternostro. My other recommendation is actually a book. I'm a big fan of mysteries, and you know, I read the entire Stieg Larsson series, which is, you know, and I was very sad when, you know, I learned that I would not be reading any more Stieg Larsson after his, you know, untimely death. But I did discover Jo Nesbø, who is a Norwegian crime writer. And so, you know, I would recommend any of his books, but the one that I just finished was The Snowman. You know, it is really dark, it is very suspenseful. And, you know, it's set in Oslo. And so you get, you know, one of the things I really liked about the Stieg Larsson books is that you felt like you got to know that city. You got to know...
that little island that they were
on. Oh, yeah. But, I mean, a couple of his other books are set in that big Swedish city.
We're terrible.
But in this one, you get to really... you get to know Oslo. It's, you know, it's a great read.
Isn't there a show that you watch as well with little Stevie from
Oslo as well? Yes.
What's that called?
I can't remember.
All right. So my recommendation is a book as well, and it's Garth Stein's The Art of Racing in the Rain. And it's a very, very cute, very easy read. It's a story written from the perspective of the dog, and it's sad and cute and funny, and it was a great book. I got it from my mother for Christmas, and my dad actually read it before she did, and he said it made him cry.
Aww.
Which kind of shocked me, because my dad doesn't cry very much, but yeah, so... So yeah, that was a really, really enjoyable book. I actually listened to it on audio, and that was great as well. All right. So that's it for our podcast for this week. So you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Lila68. That's Lila68.
And I'm. You can reach me at Zaveri, Me, Z-A-V-E-R-I-M-I.
All right. So
we'll catch you next week.
Yeah.